This is Paul Nichols, the investor coach, and we are joining Mark Mattson for another hour. I should say Mark has been kind enough to join us. And yes, we've preempted Rush. Ain't it great? So now you're going to get some good financial information. And I guess you can pick up Rush later if you'd like and pick up some political. That's his shtick, I guess. We are here to talk about our shtick, which is finance. And I'm with Mark Mattson, my coach. He recently wrote a book, Main Street Money, is on a national tour, multi-city bus tour, promoting the book and the public broadcasting special, which premiered last week. Let's get into the nitty-gritty with Mark. He's written this book. I've read, almost finished it. It's awesome. I love it. My favorite chapter so far is the wealth creation chapter. But what most people will probably be interested in is the investor dilemma. I think that's what hits most people. When you get the book, and I think for most people that you coach up, coach advisors, when we hear the whole investor dilemma, light bulbs go on because it starts to explain why people do imprudent things.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk a little bit about that, the investor dilemma, and tie in wealth creation. If you can weave that together, yeah, that'd be awesome.
Well, the natural state of the investor is doubt and fear and scarcity. And no more intense than in the last two or three years with such political turmoil, financial turmoil, high unemployment, gas prices going through the roof. And, you know, most investors have kind of taken the ostrich approach and kind of put their heads down in the sand. They're trying to wait until things look safe before they actually start learning to invest. And the problem is that with that is that, you know, when they feel like that, what they want is they want somebody to try to predict the future. Because wouldn't it be a lot easier if someone could just tell you if the market was going to go up or what stocks were going to do well? And then they start looking for, you know, people that have been able to do it in the past. You know, people that...
Solutions.
Yeah, they're looking for people that have a huge track record, that have beat the market in the past, hoping they'll do it in the future. Then they buy those investors, those so-called gurus. And then, well, many times they find that they're underperforming the market by 2 to 5%. And they, you know, and then they have more fear and doubt about the future because they're losing money, and that cycle just kind of perpetuates itself again and again and again. And Wall Street feeds off of that perplexing dilemma that all investors suffer from. And you got, and the goal of the investor should be get off of that merry-go-round once and for all.
You know, Mark, a lot of people are not familiar with Dalbar. Maybe because I think that just speaks to the proof being in the pudding as it relates to what most Americans are getting. Can you tell them a little bit about Dalbar and their quantitative study they do every year?
Yeah, the research shows that investors, even though the S&P over the last 20 years has been over 9% per year, and keep in mind, listeners, that at 9%, your money would double very quickly in less than 10 years. If you're getting a 9% rate of return, your money's doubling that fast. And that's even given the last 10 years where the market's been extremely volatile on the downside.
That's an annual return.
Yeah, the annual return. So, but the average investor investing in mutual funds, whether it's in your 401k or your personal money, the average investor has only made 3%. So think about that. You're looking at 6% difference between what an investor made versus what the market made, because investors are buying these funds that are loaded up with expenses, and then they're panicking and getting in and out.
Now, for those of you that may not think that you're part of that, hey, that's the other guy, that's not me. You know, denial is not a river in Egypt, okay? The fact of the matter is, let me share a simple thought with you, rule of 72, which Mark just kind of spoke to. There's a mathematical thing you can do in your head. It's called the rule of 72. If, in fact, you're getting 9% published returns in your portfolio, 9 goes into 72 8 times. The idea of the rule of 72 is you can take a yield and interest rate of return, divide it or multiply it into 72, and get the inverse time that it takes to double. So if most of published returns are 10 and 12% out there, ladies and gentlemen, your money should be doubling about every 6 to 8 years. But the fact of the matter is, after analyzing hundreds and you could say tens of thousands of portfolios, yep, what we find is that most Americans' money doubles about every 12 to 15 years, which means by sheer mathematical certainty that they're not getting that kind of return. They're really getting closer to that 4 or 5% return after the fees. And it's the fees that really eats it up and the constant trading, right?
Yeah, and I was just I was in New York City a couple of days ago, and I was actually on the street interviewing people and asking them about retirement and what they thought about retirement. And the challenge for investors with their 401ks and their portfolios is that most investors that I've met don't believe that Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, they don't believe they can depend on the federal government for their retirement. And I think they're right. There's $15 trillion of debt. And if the federal government had to report their debts and deficits the way a company does, there would be $65 trillion of debt. That's $271,000 per family. I don't know. Most families don't have that money to pay that debt off, and it's only getting worse. So the idea, you know, that you think you're going to be in retirement 10, 20, 30, 40 years and that the federal government's going to be there to protect you, just look at Greece. You have to be 100% accountable for the money that you're going to have from your, for your retirement. And if you get any from the federal government, count that as a blessing. But don't count it on a guarantee.
Well, you're right. The current deficit's $15 trillion. That's what people hear, right, in that number. But you're right. It's 65. And what they mean by the other 50 comes from Medicare and Social Security because they're unfunded.
Yeah, that doesn't show up on the balance sheet.
Right.
That's off balance sheet funding.
And just as a rant on an ironic little thing, I did something on Social Security recently. It was originally set up as a insurance type of program. It wasn't set up as an entitlement program. If they would have insured it and done it the way that health insurance and other types of programs work, it would be there.
That, the initial Social Security withdrawal was 1% of your pay. Now it's up to your contribution and your employer's contribution. You're looking at almost 15%. Can you imagine how much wealth Americans would have if they were able to access their own 15% and invest it for their future? Most people would have millions of dollars of money of their own that's been sucked up by the federal government and then borrowed out in the form of IOUs. In essence, I mean, this is the Ponzi scheme that would make even Ponzi blush. Madoff envies this thing. And you cannot count on it. You cannot count on it for your retirement. And that makes the investing prudently and growing your wealth that much more important. And if you don't understand this, the fact is over 95% of all Americans end up running out of money in retirement. 95%. You don't want to be in that statistic.
And, you know, it's the fear of that. None of us want to be there. It's the fear of that that propagates this investor dilemma. That we're constantly trying to win and beat the market and stay ahead of the curve, when in actuality there's no science. There's not one study that proves it out, right, Mark? I mean, you're with these Nobel laureates and all that. Have you seen any study that proved out stock picking, market timing, or track record investing in any variance?
There's not one single academic study that proves that any of that is an effective way to manage your money. And one of the things I see happening across the country right now is this explosion of ETFs. And those are just new ways and forms of speculating and gambling with your money. And there's over 1,300 of them. I mean, you can buy options and grain and timber and gold. And all these are very speculative forms of investing. And anytime, if you're an investor out there and you are hearing the word alternative investor or investment, if you're hearing it from your advisor or you're seeing it online, look, there is no alternative to prudent investing. And if it has the word alternative by it, that is speculating and gambling.
Right. It's like the term progressive. What does that mean anymore? You know, it's
that
been used
socialism
in so many ways.
And communism.
I don't know.
I'll tell you what it means.
But, you know.
That means communism.
Yeah.
That's what that means.
So it's this fear of not knowing the future and the fear that we need this retirement money and the fact that the deficit's looming for and so on that leads to this constant cycle of people trying to predict. And that's why the average holding, it blows my mind, is what, like 3 years?
3 years. Even though investors say they're long-term, they'll buy a mutual fund because it just had stellar performance. Then they'll get disappointed, and within 2 to 3 years, they're going to sell it. And then that's why part of the reason why the returns are so pathetic. And another reason is that they do not understand how wealth is really created. You asked about that chapter in the book.
I love that chapter.
And the wealth is not created because some brilliant guru on Wall Street tells you what stocks are the best ones to buy. It gets created through capitalism. And the wonderful thing about the market is that you can capture 12,000 companies globally, 45 different countries, and you are directly tapping in to evolutionary forces of competition, new technology, mutating companies. And what happens, what real wealth creation happens when an entrepreneur takes data, information, or even metals and raw materials and combines them and organizes them in the way that people want them. That's why the federal government can never create real wealth, because they can only confiscate and redistribute. They can't create like Apple. They can't organize, you know, molecules and neurons, et cetera, into something like the iPhone or the iPad. Wealth can only be created through free will, never through coercion.
Well, there's a significant group of people out there, and I don't want to get into a political conversation, that think the government creates jobs. And the younger people are under that impression.
Well, they are, and they're sadly mistaken. And what I'm always telling people is that, you know, you should act, even if you are liberal, you should act as if you're conservative in your own life.
Fiscally, anyway.
Yeah,
right?
Because you should never count on the government for anything. And I'm always telling my kids, look, you know, you need to be 100% accountable for your for everything. I personally don't think anything, by the time if I'm 48 years old, I don't think there's going to be anything available anywhere for me. I mean, there's going to be two systems. There's going to be, you know, if this Obamacare doesn't get destroyed somewhere along the way, there's going to be two healthcare systems, one where you can't really get healthcare, and then private healthcare where you're having to pay for it, like in Europe and in the UK.
Just going to get more expensive.
And it's going to get more expensive. You're going to get less services. Hey, I have two artificial hips. You know, you're probably not going to be, you know, somewhere down the road, you may not be able to get that kind of technology unless you have your own money.
Yeah, in fact, that's an incredible story. I don't want to get into it, but you got to pick up the book for that. Mark's personal health challenges. It was really a touching part of the book, and I think your daughter almost had a similar one, but yeah, you had caught it. I don't want to get into it, but you got to pick up the book to read that part. I want to stay on the investor dilemma because, you know, we've talked about the bullies of Wall Street. That's kind of the message of Main Street money. A part of the message is the bullies, but a bigger part of the message is how to overcome it. So let's talk a little bit about how do we overcome this investor dilemma, this fear of failure and all that.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I was in third grade. I was getting picked on in school. And my dad came home early for work one day, and I was actually kind of on the front step of our apartment. I was kind of crying a little bit there. I'll admit that. And he said, "What's wrong?" You know, I said, "Well, these kids are picking on me." And he's like, "Well, you're going to have to stand up to them." I'm like, "Well, what do you mean they're bigger?" He says, "Well, I don't care how big they are. You're going to have to stand up to them. And the next time they push you, I know this isn't politically correct anymore, but you're going to have to punch them in the nose and stand up for yourself." And it was scary, but I did. And once I stood up for myself, the bullies never picked on me again. So the first step of protecting yourself from the Wall Street bullies is being 100% accountable and stand up to them. And the way that you stand up to them is to get informed and get knowledgeable and study not what the Wall Street wants you to study, but what academia, like at the University of Chicago, and what we've been able to do in the book is we've taken PhD level academics of how to invest money, and I made it accessible for Main Street so that you can understand it and you can arm yourself. You got to do the footwork, you got to get in the game, and you have to get knowledgeable. You can't just sit on the sidelines and trust some Wall Street guy with your money.
Well, there's one chapter in there called It's Science, and that really that part alone would be more knowledge than I think most advisors.
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about that because I'm coaching individual investors. You're coaching me, the advisor.
Yeah.
So if it's hard for the individual investor to follow the rules, what have you found about advisors? I'm curious.
Okay, here's the deal. Present company outstanding. Advisors are actually worse than investors.
Is the blind leading the blind?
Well, it is, because what happens to advisors is that advisors, there's this instinct in nature called herding. And like when sheep are attacked or there's danger, you know, they will herd into a great big, you know, flock. You know, birds do it, fish do it, and it's to protect yourself from the enemies. Well, money managers do it too. And when things are volatile or things happen, what money managers kind of huddle up and start doing the exact same thing at the exact same time. And that's always the wrong thing to do. So, for example, gold starts going up. Everybody starts jumping on the gold after it's already up. The market crashes, 2008, 2009. All the advisors panic and tell you to go to cash because it sounds cool and you think you can get on, you know, TV and to talk about those things. So what will happen is I've actually seen advisors, when the market crashed in 2008, 2009, take $60 million of their clients' money and sell out of the market at the very low point, and they already knew the rules of investing. They already knew the academic side of it, and they just destroyed all those investors. And that is absolutely a very sad thing. Most advisors aren't any better than an investor.
Well, you know, I live by a mantra, stand for something or fall for anything. So it was real easy. And I noticed you mentioned that in the book. It was real easy for me to adopt the science because it just makes sense to me. And I've never had a problem with the contrarian stance personally. But I know it's not comfortable for a lot of people. And, you know, you're going to put yourself, we're going to be big targets when this book gets out.
Yep.
Because you really call out the industry. And not only the industry, but you're on, you know, the mainstream shows. So even the people that are all part of the show. So the investor dilemma is a constant. They're getting barraged by all this. So I can see why the average investor has a hard time staying disciplined. The average advisor should not have a problem staying disciplined, but it speaks to the fact that they don't know the science.
They
forgot it from school,
well,
one of the two.
It's kind of, unfortunately, it's kind of like drinking. A lot of people try to stop drinking.
Well, that's true.
Or gambling or eating too much.
Right.
And they stay sober for a while or they stay, you know, they lose some weight. But then they end up, relapsing, and they're doing the same thing they were always doing.
Well,
and so it's not a matter of knowledge; it's a matter of behavior.
Yes, but you would hope that the knowledge would dictate the behavior, right? And unfortunately, they don't have the knowledge that they need.
How many of you know you shouldn't eat cheesecake? But I ate some last night.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, the investor dilemma. How do you solve it then? Because really, what you're speaking to is the fact that people need to get more coached up, and that's what I love about the. The 20 must-answer questions, which is kind of the focal point of our whole mantra in the book, if you will. And I have to just go back and tell you guys a quick story. When I first met Mark, I went to Cincinnati, and I sat in a room with maybe 40 other advisors or something. And I was probably the younger guy in that particular group. And a lot of seasoned guys were there, guys that had been managing money, hundreds of millions for 20, 30, 40 years. We went through this 20 questions. You could hear a pin drop in that room. It was obvious that something was on everybody's mind. And you go out to the break after we take a break, and guys were hanging their head all over the place. And that, to me, was the epiphany, Mark. It wasn't so much information. That obviously made sense. That was the epiphany for me when I looked around and I said, my goodness, these guys are in the business. You know, and they are hanging their head because they can only answer three or four or five of these questions. I thought, that's a sad state of where we are. And, you know, a lot of people, especially in an academic community, feel like because they got a PhD in one thing, they're supposed to be smart in everything. And I'm going to let them off the hook. It's about progress, not perfection. And you can't know everything about everything. We all need coaching, you know, and in the most obvious areas, right?
Well, just because you know what a scalpel is doesn't mean you're a doctor.
Right.
Just because you know what a mutual fund is doesn't mean that, you know, you're qualified to be able to manage money. And, you know, you're right. When I have taught over 1,000 financial planners, money managers, experts in the field of investing, and the average of when I give them this 20 must answer test, the average is about 3.5.
Yeah, I can answer 3. That's what I did.
And they probably lied on one or two of them. that's how. But they're questions that when you hear them, everybody knows they should already know. For example, do you know for every level of risk in your portfolio that you're taking, the expected rate of return that you're getting? I mean, how simple.
Yeah.
Two things.
Yeah.
What's the risk you're taking and can you measure it? And what's the expected rate of return in your portfolio based on the mix of assets? And nobody can answer it. I have never seen one advisor in 20 years be able to come in and answer just those two simple questions. But they're managing sometimes tens or 20, $100 million.
And these guys and gals aren't people that don't want to know that answer, but it speaks to the fact that the industry doesn't propagate this information.
No, Wall Street doesn't want you to ask that question. You know, another question I ask people is, you know, this is going to get kind of touchy feeling, is what is your true purpose for money? You know, because, you know, everyone knows that, you know, money is not the most important thing. You know, money can't buy you love, you know, all those kind of things.
Right.
But everybody acts as if it were true because you spend 7 to 10 hours a day working and then thinking about money and thinking about all this stuff. But the reality is money can't make you happy.
Right.
And sometimes I've seen investors with the largest portfolios, $4, $5, $6, $10 million, they were the most miserable because they didn't have a true purpose for money, something that's greater than money itself. Because the default position for money is speculating and gambling if you don't have a true purpose. For example, my true purpose for money is love. I know that sounds touchy-feely, and most people think, well,
corny, yeah, but it's real. Right?
But that is my guide and my compass for how I invest my money. That means I don't want to speculate and gamble it, and it's also my guide for how I want to spend my money. And when you have a true purpose for money, it is a great guide for what you're going to do, how you're going to live your life, so that if I have $100 million, I can express love. But even if I only have $1, I can go out in the world and create love by just giving a card to a friend in the hospital. So when you have a true purpose for money, any amount is enough.
You know, these questions are very important, the 20 must-answer questions. And like Mark's saying, he just mentioned a couple of them. One of the things I always ask people is, if you could answer some of these questions, how would you feel about your money? And most people said, I'd feel very comfortable about it. I don't even need to answer all 20. If I can answer 10, I'd be pretty comfortable about my money. And what but the first thing that happens whenever we talk to people and kind of share these myths versus the truths of investing is automatic physical appearances of denial. And it's like, why isn't this guy just, you know, he's just a conspiracy theorist. Mark, you're just a conspiracy theorist, man. You're talking about bullies and all this kind of stuff. You know, but you're involved in the industry. What do you say when somebody says, well, you sound like a conspiracy theorist here?
What I've heard people say is, well, you're just brainwashing people.
Right.
I said, well, that's interesting.
Brain cleansing, right?
Yeah, because, I think that's interesting because I think they've already been brainwashed. As a matter of fact, Wall Street, I dropped my, about 5 years ago, I dropped my 10-year-old, he's 16 now, he's taller than me, but he was 10 at the time, 11, and I dropped him off at school. And right out in front of the school, it said, Merrill Lynch congratulates little Billy for winning the stock picking game. And so when the kids are 10 years old, the big brokerage firms are coming in teaching these kids to speculate and gamble with money. It might as well say, you know, little Billy won craps night, or little Billy won Russian roulette night. Or, I mean, this is absolutely insane. Talk about brainwashing people. People don't even know there's another way to look at how they manage their money. That's what's been brainwashed.
So basically what's happening is when people say conspiracy theory, the fact of the matter is that anything seems like a conspiracy when very few people understand what's going on about it.
Well, actually, it is a conspiracy, quite frankly.
It is. I would agree.
Wall Street.
We just sound like wackos when we say it.
It's a quiet conspiracy. I mean, but they know. Look, all these big mutual fund companies know they don't know what the market's going to do. They know they don't know what the best stocks are in advance. That's why they have sometimes as much as 200 different mutual funds. They know they don't know.
Well, I've always been surprised how their profits go up when the market goes down.
Well, they'll just switch you to something else.
No, it's the transactions. It's not in managing the money overall. It must be in the transactions.
Yeah, and what they do is they have all these products so that they can give the false perception that they actually have the ability to beat the market. But when I do a seminar and I have 100 people in a room like I did, you know, downtown Manhattan last night, and then we start flipping coins, and someone's going to always, out of a group of 100 people, someone's going to get lucky and flip heads 10 times in a row. That's not because they're genius or have coin flipping skills. They're just lucky. And that's the exact same thing on Wall Street. You see these guys with these big hedge funds or these, gambling and speculating this money. You think they're brilliant. Really, they're just orangutans flipping coins.
But that's the implication. That's what they're implying, that they're brilliant.
Absolutely they are.
You know, hey, you're listening to Mark Matson, the author of Main Street Money. My name is Paul Nichols, your host. You're listening to a special broadcast of It's Your Money. We're pulling back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposing the truth about money and investing. And we got about another half hour with Mark. We're going to take a hard break. We're going to come back, and we're going to spend a little time talking about some of these questions as it relates to the book. And really, what's our goal? What's our mantra now? What are we trying to accomplish? And I know what that is. That's save the investor. We're going to talk more about saving the investor when we come back. You're listening to It's Your Money. We'll be right back.